I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Anna Stiltz, Lawrence S. Rockefeller Professor of Politics and Human Values at Princeton University. We're discussing her 2019 book, Territorial Sovereignty, A Philosophical Exploration. Stiltz's research focuses on questions of political membership, authority and political obligation, nationalism and self-determination, rights to land and territory, and collective agency. She is the author of Liberal Loyalty, Freedom, Obligation, and the State, as well as many articles. Let's get started then. And so, first of all, let me say, Annie Stiltz, thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me. This is very exciting.
So, Annie, I love the book. It's a great defense, or I should say maybe qualified defense, of a state's territorial sovereignty. And you execute that defense really with very compelling, rigorous arguments. And so well done. Congrats on the achievement of the new book. Can you say a bit at the very beginning here about the motivation for writing the book? What led you to write about this topic in particular now?
Yeah, so I've been actually working on the topic for about 10 years. So it took me a really long time to write the book. And it may seem like the subject matter is extremely topical given the political juncture that we're currently in, but that's not what motivated me to work on it, given that I started.
It's very prescient. You're very prescient.
I suppose there were kind of two motivations that overlapped for me. One was that in my first book, I wrote about the kind of moral importance of citizenship and also state authority, and from a kind of Kantian background. And part of that book was sort of a critique of an alternative kind of more nationalist account of, the moral value of citizenship. And kind of through reading a lot of that sort of more liberal nationalist kind of literature, I became really interested in a lot of the topics that liberal nationalists are really concerned about. Like, what land should we have rights over, or what language should we all speak, or these kinds of things. And I felt like that those topics were ones that in more kind of traditional sort of liberal democratic theories, they didn't get a lot of airtime. And I thought that they could be, quite interesting. I wanted to give a different kind of answer to different kind of account of, what land should we live on and so on, and what are our rights over it than liberal nationalists typically do. But I thought it was a really interesting question. So that was one motivating force for me. And then I think the other motivating force for me was just, I felt like increasingly, both in the world in which we live and also in the political theory literature, there were a lot of reasons to be critical of the sovereign state system. And I kind of outlined some of those reasons in the introduction to the book. Failures of collective action and addressing important problems that face us today, inequality, unfreedom, the problems of war. And I was really genuinely wondering, whether there was something morally to be said in favor of this system of territorial states that we live in, whether there were kind of ethical or moral principles that might support or legitimate it, or whether it was something that we should, try to reform. And I think I wanted to, kind of think deeply about that question. And so that was another motivation.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it strikes me that, a couple of different strands of contemporary political theory and political philosophy are directly relevant to this, right? I mean, the literature and political theory on colonialism and empire is, one of its central questions is, what morally to do about lands that were taken in past injustices, and in the literature and political philosophy on cosmopolitanism, which is one of your main focuses in the book. If the globe belongs to all of humanity, how is it that we can legitimate some kind of land over particular nation states? And so this book really speaks. I was reading it, seeing a lot of connections with other work that's going on. So that's great. So maybe we could start by talking about the main concept or topic in the book, which is the notion of territorial rights, which is, as far as I understood it, the rights that a state has over the control of its land, the ability it has to exclude others, to control its borders, and to exploit its resources, among several other things you talk about. And this is interesting because most liberal scholars talk about the legitimacy of the state, coercion over its members, but you're taking up the legitimacy that the state has the control over its land. Do I have that right as a sort of just brief overview of the notion of, you know, the sort of topic of the book, the main concept, the notion of territorial rights, or anything you want to add there?
Sure. No, that sounds right. Yeah. So I think the sort of claim that was of interest to me was this claim that that states have to their territories, which generally encompasses a kind of claim to make and enforce law in that area. That's what I call a claim of jurisdiction. And to do that without interference from other people. So, you know, not to be sort of subjected to regime change or intervention, at least in the normal case. But also these kind of what I call more exclusionary sovereignty claims, which, you know, bear a kind of analogy to sort of more property-like claims that landowners might make over their holdings, including the right to, you know, exclude migrants potentially, and the right to claim the value of the natural resources on the territory. Now, I don't justify the kind of fullest version of all those sovereignty claims. I'm critical of some of them, but I was sort of the subject matter of the book is, you know, can those claims, you know, be given any kind of compelling justification or not? And I think there is an interesting difference between, you know, the more standard analyses of state legitimacy, which really focus on the state's claims vis-a-vis its own citizens, and these more territorial claims, because one of the, you know, key features of these territorial claims is that they bind outsiders. They exclude outsiders from doing things within a certain sort of geographical area of the earth. So from sort of setting up an alternative regime there, for example, or from potentially from entering the territory and settling there, or from claiming the natural resources there. So the relationship, the kind of duty bearer relationship is different with respect to territorial rights than it is with respect to what we might think of as more internal claims of sovereignty or political authority.
Yeah, that's good. And it seems to me maybe a good way to frame it, which is, you know, in terms of what you don't argue, which are two different ways, I think, that you can take this issue of territorial rights. I mean, one is to go all the way in the direction that the state has an absolute, like, private property ownership over the particular land, over its territory, which you don't argue, so that it can do whatever it wants or exclude whomever it wants under any conditions. And on the other hand, there's a sort of a cosmopolitan approach that I just mentioned a few moments ago, that the state really doesn't have any rights at all, or it's a sort of illegitimate for a state to claim any rights, and that the earth belongs to all human beings. So your approach, I take it, is somewhere in between those two. Is that maybe a right way to set it up?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I don't actually dispute the cosmopolitan premise that the earth belongs to all human beings in a certain sense. But I suggest that even if that's true, the best interpretation of what common ownership idea could mean is one that's got to be compatible with certain kinds of claims that people have to land and place and to build their lives in particular places, to set up self-determining states in those places, and certain kinds of limited exclusionary claims under certain conditions. So, the thought is, it's true that the earth belongs to us all, but the way that we should understand that idea is that we each have the right to use it, to build our lives and to form, you know, autonomous self-governing structures within it. And so there's a sense in which common ownership persists in my account, in that I suggest that, you know, we need to think of the values of territorial sovereignty that I argue for in the book as universal values, and they should be satisfied for everyone on Earth. And that means that sometimes, you know, it might be necessary to revise existing territorial claims if, you know, a state's control over its current territory is not compatible with other people on Earth's enjoyment of those values. So there's a sense in which the background of common ownership exerts continuing constraints. But I just think that you can have the cosmopolitan understanding of common ownership can be understood. It's too robust, and it needs to be understood in a manner that's kind of compatible with located social and cultural and political practices that we have reason to value.
Yeah, that's helpful. I mean, I guess when we get to it, I am interested in how some of that, you know, that underlying cosmopolitan premise can be enforced against states, especially when they don't live up to the kinds of duties that are expected of them, the cosmopolitan right. Mm-hmm. But maybe that's too early to get there. I mean, talking about this main argument of the book, I mean, to justify the claim that you make about a state's territorial sovereignty, the state is justified in having territorial rights because or under the conditions in which it realizes three core values. I'm not sure if that's the right way to put it, but maybe you could correct me if I'm wrong. So the three core values that you talk about, which we'll talk about in what follows, are the right to occupancy, that people are allowed to use specific geographical places to realize the kinds of practices that they care about, which is what you just mentioned. The second is the notion of basic justice, that states secure justice, security, and subsistence and autonomy within their borders, and that states realize the collective self-determination of its people to express a kind of collective political will. Did I get that right? Yeah. Feel free to correct me. Okay, go ahead.
That's right. So my thought is, you know, I started off from this kind of a set of worries about the territorial system and a kind of cosmopolitan critique of that system. And what I say is that even though I'm not, I don't want to defend the territorial state system that we actually have in its full current form, I do think that some central features of a system of territorial states, and especially the kind of structuring role that it grants to bounded jurisdictional units, I do think that that is morally defensible. And the reason why it's morally defensible is that it serves what I think are three core values that we ought to think are important, and that really sort of tell in favor of maintaining an international order of self-governing territorial units. And those three core values are this idea of a right of occupancy, the value of what I call basic justice, and the value of collective self-determination.
I mean, one of the features seems to me right off the bat of thinking about those three values is that they refer to the people who exist in the land now rather than, I guess you could say, the past history of the people who may have used to have lived on that particular land. So I guess, I mean, which you do, and I should say you do address this. So maybe you could just say a little bit about it now, because it's issue in thinking about territorial sovereignty, which is how the past injustices that a state has committed sort of complicate a certain view about the state's claim to territorial sovereignty. I mean, just for example, I mean, the United States unjustly displaced Native Americans from their land. So does the U.S. rightfully own the territory in which it covers?
Yeah, so that's a big challenge. And a lot of my book is kind of focused on, you know, different ways in which that challenge arises and what we ought to say about it. So, you know, a strong view would suggest that no state has title to its territory, in part because of the wrongful kind of acts of dispossession and conquest and expulsion and genocide that often kind of feature in the history of how states acquired their land. So I take that challenge seriously. But I argue that, ultimately that a state does not have to have a kind of untainted chain of historical title in order to establish legitimate sovereignty over its territory today. And that's because I argue that this idea of a right of occupancy, which is really the kind of central claim that attaches people to land, in my view, that's one that's founded on having what I call located life plans in an area that were established without wrongdoing. So that's going to mean if you're just sort of faultlessly born somewhere, your located life plans in that area were not established through some sort of wrongful act on your part. And this is going to mean that over the generations, the kind of salience of historic dispossession is going to lessen. Now, I do think that sometimes you can have, you know, descendants of, say, wrongful settlers who still bear ongoing obligations to facilitate the return of the victims they expelled or perhaps the descendants of those victims. And I talk a good bit about, you know, the moral basis for rights of return in chapter 3 of my book. But I don't think of territory as sort of the object of a property right that can be passed down indefinitely through generations in the way that that some thinkers do. And I appeal to certain intuitions I think that we have about cases to sort of motivate this. So, you know, I don't think that, you know, the descendants of Germans who were expelled from Eastern Europe after World War II or the descendants of Jews who were expelled from similar areas, or the descendants of Huguenots who were expelled from France. I don't think that in general those people have kind of ongoing rights of return to the areas that their grandparents or great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents once inhabited. So I do appeal to that kind of bedrock intuition to sort of suggest that we need an alternative to kind of a historic view of land rights.
Yeah, good. I mean, I thought we could talk about that first part on occupancy rights, because I am curious about how to think about the right a state might have over the land. I mean, as you say, it's something like a private property, so it reminds me a bit of Locke. I mean, there's a kind of element of Lockeanism that's in your view, because Locke has a view that all the world belongs to all in common, and yet human beings have a right to exclude others. I mean, Locke has this view about mixing labor in order to acquire private property, which isn't in your view, but Locke has this proviso about leaving enough and is good for others, which I take it is something behind your view. But at the same time, there are disanalogies between occupancy rights and private property rights for you, that it, you know, we don't have the absolute right to exclude others, and you can't pass down the right of ownership to future generations in the way you just mentioned. So maybe you could sort of just help me think about how I should think about occupancy rights.
Yeah. So for me, occupancy is something like a right to reside permanently in a particular place, and to make use of that space for social and cultural and economic practices that one values. And I argue in chapter 2 that occupancy rights are grounded in the role that geographical places often play in our most central kind of life commitments. So the thought is that we build our lives in particular places and in the expectation that we will be able to continue to use those places, and that security of expectation is a very important kind of background precondition for our well-being and for our autonomy. So the thought is that because our life projects are bound up with particular places, interference with our use and possession of those places undermines our autonomy by undermining the lives that we've built. But I do say that, you know, I do rely on natural rights thinking in arguing for occupancy. But I don't appeal to sort of Lockean ideas. I rely on Hugo Grotius in sort of theorizing occupancy. And in particular, I rely on this idea that Grotius has that there was a kind of primitive use right that that human beings might have had over the world, even prior to the invention of anything like private property. So the thought is that prior to the invention of private property, it wasn't like we couldn't use anything. And in using things, Grotius also thinks we place other people under duties to respect our uses of things, because the areas that we're using are extremely important for our well-being and for our autonomy. So we have a moral duty to respect other people as autonomous equals. And that can lead to a derivative duty to respect their uses of certain areas that are really important for their lives. So that's the kind of idea that I appeal to. But I suggest that a use right is a lot more limited than anything like a full property claim. So a use right typically doesn't give rise to kind of what you might think of as sort of market-based incidents of property, like the right to derive income from something, the right to sell it, the right to bequeath it to your heirs, which is sort of related to this claim that occupancy rights don't descend down generations in the way that people think property rights can. So I think that the fact that occupancy is really more like a use right over our common earth means that it's a weaker and more limited right than you might think of a Lockean property right as being.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I was thinking about your cases in this part, and one of the things that struck me is that, okay, I mean, so your argument, you know, has to do with the kind of, with the autonomous, you know, is based on a kind of view of individual autonomy and sort of pursuing a certain view of the good life, which requires as a condition for its possibility certain land to pursue our economic, social, political activities. One of the things that's interesting about that is, you know, sort of, you know, the way which it's a kind of modern conception. And I say that in the sense of, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, more of an ancient or traditional way of thinking about human beings' connection to the land is a lot more, I don't know how to put it other than say, you know, spiritual or religious. And the main question I wanted to ask was about how to think about the difference between maybe a traditional and a more modern way of the way our intuitions think about the connection with land. Say, I mean, the Native Americans, which you mentioned at various points, I mean, there's a way in which there's a kind of spiritual connection to the land. You mentioned a couple of religious examples, like the Israel-Palestine case. There's a sort of religious connection to land versus a more modern, secular, liberal conception of the connection with land, which is more abstract, where we have a more abstract connection. I mean, do you think that's morally relevant at all? Or I mean, I guess I'm just trying to think of how we think about the sort of rank ordering of the different interests or needs that we have when we're doing a kind of balancing act and thinking about these primitive occupancy rights.
Well, I recognize that the language that I use to describe people's interest in place as rooted in a connection with their well-being and autonomy is not the way that all people would describe their own interests in place, for sure. But I don't think that that invalidates my description. I mean, in part, I'm looking for a language that is kind of higher order and neutral enough to be capable of capturing a variety of different, more particular ways of conceiving a connection to place. So, for example, I take it that you know, one of our most comprehensive life commitments are our religious beliefs and commitments. So that gets kind of folded into or features in my account as one aspect of our kind of autonomous life projects. Now, I recognize that, you know, an indigenous individual would not use that language in describing their own commitments. But I'm not sure that that means that that it invalidates the use of, you could think of my language as a kind of meta language that's trying to provide a standpoint by which we could encompass a whole variety of more particularistic kinds of attachments. I wouldn't want to privilege, you know, only spiritual connections with the land, I think, because I think that you would have, that people have a lot of different kinds of connections with the places that matter to them. And if we were to privilege only land connections that were rooted in kind of, you know, religious practices or ideology, then that would miss out a number of other important forms of attachment that should matter to us. So the idea that I have of kind of us having important located life plans is meant to be sort of abstract and neutral enough to encompass a range of different kind of more particular attachments.
Yeah, that's good. I guess what I'm trying to drive at imperfectly here is that when thinking about maybe, you know, the kind of conflicts that you might see in a state of nature, or even when you leave the state of nature, it seems to me on your view, there's an element of how to balance or compare different life plans and the urgency of them in cases of conflict. Right. And I guess part of it is I'm wondering how to think about the different, we should think about the weighting of the importance of different, you know, like, are economic life plans maybe less important than, you know, something more basic, for example. I think about this, I guess, maybe to just narrow, you know, get it more focused. In the case of, you know, religious life plans, a religious feature of our life plans, I mean, some religious communities do make a certain kind of claim to being able to transmit their land from generation to generation, right? You use the example of, you know, the Israel-Palestine case, which is a very vexed case, but at least in that, I mean, the claim in the Old Testament is, you know, that God gave this land to the Jewish people and that it's passed from generation to generation. I don't know if that helps sort of, you know, make this a little bit more concrete.
Sure. So it's true that my view isn't going to legitimate all claims to land that people make. I do say, for example, in my chapter 3 that there are some cases in which occupancy rights can extend through the generations. Even though I don't assume that that will always happen. And one of those cases, the two cases that really interest me are one where, you know, you've expelled some population and they haven't been able to form flourishing lives in some other place, either because they're second-class citizens in some other country, or they continue to be refugees, or they're oppressed in some way. And that kind of case, I think they can retain an ongoing claim to return. And another case that I think people can retain an ongoing claim to return is where lands are especially fundamental to their religious or cultural projects, such that they can't kind of practice their religion or their culture without that specific place. But I think that a showing of attachment to land really has to depend on the life projects of current people, and that just the fact, you know, the fact that a religious community has a sacred text that, you know, purports to show that the land was given to them by God is not dispositive of the issue. So other people may have claims on that land as well, for example, rooted in the life projects of their current inhabitants. And, you know, I think there are constraints that have to come in to sort of specify, you know, how much and which lands people do have claims to. But I do allow that religious projects are quite important in thinking about located life plans, and they can be, in some cases, the source of ongoing claims.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and that's helpful. I mean, because this is, I think, a very useful thing about your meta language, as you say. I mean, if there are different claims in the case of conflict over land, you'd want to appeal to some kind of meta language that both sides could presumably agree upon. It seems to me what you're offering here, right?
Yeah, that's the aim. I mean, maybe one other thing to say is that I think the kind of need for something like a meta language just comes from the fact that we have to share the earth together with people that don't share our, you know, religious beliefs. So if we want to make claims on them that we can expect to have, you know, them to recognize and hold themselves to, then we've got to have some common language outside our own religious language in which to couch those claims. So I think that's going to press us towards some kind of more abstract understanding of what people's interests in the earth are that's not just grounded in our own particularistic kind of tradition.
Yeah, good. So let's turn to the second and the third values of state sovereignty over territory that you discussed in the next part, which is the basic justice and the collective self-determination that a state can offer to its people. So maybe you could say a little bit about those features and why it justifies state sovereignty over its territory.
Sure. These two additional core values. So I said there are three that feature in the book. The first one we've been talking about is this right of occupancy. But the next two are basic justice and collective self-determination. So the second value, basic justice, I argue requires the existence of states with functioning legal systems that can specify and interpret and enforce the rights of individuals. And I should be clear here that in the book, I adopt a kind of minimalist understanding of what it is to be a state. So I'm not saying that you have to have a kind of Weberian state. So to qualify as a state, what I'm really interested in is an institution that has binding collective rule setting by a public authority and the ability to enforce determinations in case of disputes. So the thought is that states in that sense, a public authority that can enforce determinations, that they are necessary to provide a kind of unitary interpretation of rights that binds everyone and to enforce those rights consistently with our independence from one another's sort of private vigilantism. But I say that in order to have the right to rule, states need to meet certain conditions. They need to respect what I call the value of basic justice by offering certain kinds of fundamental protections to their members of security and subsistence, core elements of personal autonomy and freedom in both their citizens and outsiders. So that value of basic justice sort of says the state having states or public authorities in the world, that's a good idea, but it doesn't tell us whether we ought to prefer having one state in the world or a plurality of states. And it's really the third kind of value, collective self-determination, that in my view gives us a moral reason to favor a system of states. And so here I argue that in addition to sort of meeting a minimal standard of justice, the state needs to, as I put it, reflect the shared political will of a significant majority of the cooperators in its territory. And so my thought is that a group shares a political will when they are jointly committed to a common political enterprise and to certain values and institutions that they think should structure that enterprise. So in using that kind of language of sharing a political will, I don't mean to imply that political groups sort of share a consensus on everything, or that they even share fundamental values, or that they agree about specific laws and policies. Instead, I'm thinking that in a diverse society, a group of people can have a shared intention to associate together politically and to support certain common institutions. And I think that this idea of collective self-determination is valuable for individuals who are part of that that group. So I suggest that collective self-determination for groups that do share a political will of that kind is important, because it serves an interest that individuals have in being ruled by a state that in some way reflects their own judgments and priorities. So the thought is that the process by which political decisions are made and imposed on people needs to respect their autonomy, by ensuring that institutions reflect the values and priorities of the people that they govern. And that allows us, I think, to relate to political authorities not as kind of hostile, dominating, alien forces, but rather as sort of institutions that we value and can accept. So collective self-determination is a really important value to me, and one of the main sort of goals of the book was to try to explore that value and give a good account of it.
Yeah, and it's quite an interesting account. I want to dig into it a little bit. I mean, one of the other useful things I think about that approach in your book is to the way in which you marshal it to discuss cases in which national minorities or minority peoples who are not, their will is not being expressed, or the will is being frustrated by majority will. You know, cases of minority secession from communities, for example. I mean, the way that you develop this is very helpful there for theorizing those types of groups too.
Sure. Yeah, that's definitely. As I said, I don't mean to exactly justify the order of states that we have today. So one of my thoughts is that one of the best reasons we would want to have a kind of pluralist international structure of distinct self-governing units is because we think self-determination is important. But when we look around at the world that we live in and the international law that we live under right now, I think we'll see that self-determination is only imperfectly realized in international law today. That's because these internal minorities are under current international law not really thought to have a binding claim to self-determination. But I think that if we think self-determination is important, we ought to think that it's important for all groups and that our international order ought to be reformed in such a way as to allow groups that don't currently enjoy self-determination a better chance to enjoy it. So that is one of the main claims in my book. I mean, I do accept that self-determination is not an absolute value. So, you know, if redrawing political boundaries for a group is going to lead to human rights violations or ethnic conflict or something, there are sometimes reasons for overriding a claim to self-determination. But I do think it's an important value and one that our international order ought to, you know, go further in trying to realize than it now does.
Yeah. And how much, I mean, this is just on, for example, on that kind of case, I mean, how much do you think these kinds of claims to self-determination on the part of minority groups should lend itself to, you know, outright secession, in which a minority group should claim rights over that land? And to what extent do you think, you know, these kinds of minority claims should trigger a kind of internal revision on the part of the state to sort of more better accommodate the minority voices? I suppose it probably depends on the case, right? But
I mean, the way that I put it in the book is that when you have a persistently alienated minority group that for some significant period of time you know, fails to affirm the institutional order that they're currently living under, then they've got a claim to self-determination, to redraw boundaries, to live in an institutional order that would better fulfill their aspirations. But you have to weigh their claim against a variety of other countervailing concerns, right? So I mentioned a couple of those earlier, like, you know, if it's going to lead to massive human rights violations or ethnic cleansing or war, then that might be a good reason for overriding their claim in some cases. And I also think there are different institutional vehicles that can accommodate self-determination. So one institutional vehicle that can go some way to self-determination, I think, is internal autonomy for minorities. So allowing them, a significant sphere of self-governance within a territorial subunit. And a lot of indigenous peoples, for example, who, you know, are small groups that cannot necessarily sustain a full economy and a full set of political institutions on their own, that's generally what they are asking for. I do think that there are some cases where there are moral claims to secession, in cases where you've got a large group that is not significantly territorially intermixed with, you know, other dissenting groups, and there's no chance of human rights violations, no chance of civil war. Both states can, you know, be well-functioning units on their own and maintain, successful economies and well-functioning institutions. Then I think you can have moral claims to secession. But I think that it's hard to institutionalize those claims as a legal right, in part because in many contexts you have these other countervailing concerns that might play a significant role. So what I say in the book is that I think as a legal matter, it's better to think about institutionalizing a right to internal autonomy for minority groups. Even though as a moral matter, sometimes there are stronger claims than internal autonomy. It's just that it's hard to say as a general rule that those ought to be binding in all contexts.
Yeah, good. Maybe you could broaden the notion here. I mean, I'm curious about your understanding of self-determination and the notion of the people that you draw on in the book, which you spend a good bit talking about. I mean, maybe it would be helpful to distinguish, because I think it was helpful for me when you distinguished your own view from the liberal nationalism view, whereby, you know, the claim liberal nationalism view is that self-determination of the notion of people is connected with or identified with a certain view of the nation or a certain nationhood. And you reject that view. So maybe you could say a little bit about how your view differs and what you see as a sort of limitation in the nationalism view.
Yeah. I understand the nationalism view as saying that the value of self-determination, the reason we care about self-determination for groups, is because there are distinct cultures in the world, and individuals have an interest in living within those distinct cultures and in protecting those cultures. And granting political self-determination to cultural groups is a good way of protecting and preserving those cultures. So I offer an alternative view in which I think that peoples are not cultural groups. Instead, they are groups that are defined by willing political cooperation together. And the value of self-determination is not really about preserving a culture. It's about enabling people to relate to their institutions in a certain way, in a way that doesn't that sees the institutions as partly reflecting their political values and priorities and not as kind of hostile or alien forces that are imposed upon them. Now, I have a long discussion of the relation between my view and liberal nationalism in the book. It's not that, you know, it's not that there isn't some overlap of concern there, I think. You might say that my view could allow cultural groups to claim self-determination. It's an absolute gulf between my view and the liberal nationalist view. So, it might be that a cultural group could claim political self-determination on my view as well. It's just that I don't see the fundamental value that's at stake in self-determination as being the preservation and protection of culture. So I try to explain that for me, it's instead this interest in political autonomy that individuals have in living under institutions that reflect their shared political priorities in a certain way. and relating to those institutions, not as kind of colonial or alien forces, but as forces that they themselves have had a hand in generating. There's some, I talk in the book at length about, you know, the overlap and difference between these two views. So I do think there's some common elements. My view is going to say that people's attitudes toward their institutions really matter. And I think the nationalists would say that, you know, if you're a cultural minority within, a distinct kind of unit that's governed by a national majority, you might feel alienated from your institutions in ways that should be of concern to me too. And what I try to say in response to that kind of line is that, I think really the fundamental dividing line between me and the nationalists is that the nationalist thinks it's okay to use the state to promote the culture of the majority group within that unit. And I don't think that that's okay. I think that ideally a just state should aim at cultural neutrality and recognition of the different cultural affiliations of its inhabitants, and not at kind of associating itself with the culture of a particular nation. So I think that is really the fundamental difference between me and the nationalists, is that you know, this idea of kind of the state belonging to a national group is something that bothers me and something that I think is potentially unjust, whereas the nationalist thinks that that's, you know, acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, I guess two things. I mean, one is, one of the things that occurs to me that what the nationalist might claim, somebody like a David Miller or even a Will Kimlicka, that it's unavoidable to appeal to something like a notion of the nation. Otherwise, to say something coherent about the people's will or a collective will, it's hard to make sense of that notion unless there's a kind of background history, set of institutions, socialization process, an entire culture that, so then you can individuate that people as a people and not something that overlaps with other groups of people. So I guess that's one concern. I don't know if you have anything to say about that. I mean, if it's even possible to sort of individuate a people without some kind of appeal to a shared history or shared language, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there is. If we were to erase all the borders off the map of the world, I'm not sure that there would be an Archimedean point out there from which we could individuate peoples. So when I think about peoples, I have this idea that what I call an endogenous theory of the people, which is that peoples are artifacts of our existing structure of political institutions. So whatever institutions we have are going to produce patterns of alienation and affirmation in people. I think that alienated groups are going to have these interests in being governed by institutions that they can more readily affirm, and that sometimes that's going to give us a reason to redraw borders for them. But I think that, you know, redrawing borders is like an ongoing process. We'll never figure out exactly how many peoples there are in the world. And this is, you know, kind of reconfiguring our institutions is something that we're going to constantly have to be doing in order to suit them to people's aspirations.
Yeah.
So I guess I want to deny that idea that the nationalist has, that we can kind of point to a set of criteria, objective criteria, by which we could determine who counts as the part of the same people with someone else.
Yeah. Tell me if I'm pushing too much on that. I mean, in part, I went back and forth with this with Sarah Song. I don't know if you know her book, which has some, I think, yeah, some good overlaps on immigration and democracy. Because she has a political self-determination view rather than a nationalistic self-determination view. And I asked similar questions. I mean, you know, one of the things that it strikes me as a problem, though, if the sort of continual redrawing of borders is that, I mean, isn't the worry that you'd be redrawing the borders based on whoever's will is the strongest or the most powerful? I mean, I'm just wondering what the procedure would be for determining
you know, to, for identifying, yes, okay, this is this is the current configuration, or that's this current. Often we find when you do, you know, engage in procedures like that, it ends up just privileging whoever's loudest or most participatory or whatever. Whereas if you have something like a nationalist view, at least there's some kind of coherent historical notion that you're all trying to converge towards.
Yeah, I guess I'm just skeptical that historical notion is really out there to give us kind of much better grounding. You know, for me, there groups with this different cultural components are going to count as peoples. You know, I kind of reference, you know, the case of India, for example. That's a group, a people with many different distinctive cultural strands. And I mean, you could say that they share common institutions within India. But it seems to me that really what makes them a people is that they are willing to cooperate together politically and to affirm their cooperation, and that if, you know, subgroups within them were, you know, persistently unwilling to do that, then they might have a claim to become a distinct people. So I agree that, you know, we don't want to accede to these claims too readily, that there are other countervailing concerns that we should weigh when we're thinking about whether to redraw boundaries or to create a new unit for another group. But I don't really think that there's like the right configuration of political units that we could get to if only we got the objective kind of markers of peoples correct.
Mm-hmm. The second point, I think there was a second question I was going to ask on this, was about the value of asserting a nation or fostering a nation or fostering a sense of national identity, which the nationalists also hold. One of the things that I agree, I mean, I can see the bite of your sort of the liberal sensibility that you offer there, that it might not be the business of a state to push some kind of majority conception of the nation on a people. But, I mean, on the other hand, it strikes me that a lot of individuals within a state have an interest as part of their life plan to see that their sense of their nation is cultivated and transmitted to the next generation, right? So, I mean, I take it a lot of, you know, in Europe with the immigration crisis, conservative Germans, right, are concerned that their sense of the German nation or whatever is in threat or of being eroded. So I just wonder about, I mean, because at least your part of your claim is that you want to take seriously the life plans of certain peoples. But on the other hand, there's a kind of worry about the assertion of a kind of national identity. I just wonder about this sort of maybe conflict between those two.
I agree that there are some claims based on culture that we should give weight to. Mm-hmm. So for example, I think that that German can, you know, justifiably raise a claim to have their children educated in German.
Mm-hmm.
They can justifiably raise a claim, I think, to having certain public spaces within Germany that reflect some of their values and aesthetic preferences and so on. But what I don't think they can claim is hegemony. That's what I really worry about. So there's a difference in saying, I want to live in a state that reflects some of my cultural values and priorities, and saying, I want to live in a state that privileges my cultural values and majority and priorities at the expense of people who might have different ones. Hmm. And it's the hegemony that I object to.
Right. You draw on your colleague, Alan Paton, right, been influential on me, too, and his view about equal recognition among different cultures in a country, which I find compelling. Although at the same time on that, well, if you have I mean, is there a kind of common ground among those? I mean, I'm assuming this is what a David Miller or a Will Kimlicka would say. Somebody like, you know, Kimlicka even, you know, there's a nation of Canada's the most multicultural countries on earth. But yet it still has a nation on his view, because the nation is form of multiculturalism.
I agree at one point in my book that if you want to use the term nation to describe a kind of common sense of political participation and cooperation, that you know, there's not really a distinction between what I'm talking about and that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what is often appealed to in addition to the common sense of political cooperation and participation is some set of objective cultural markers that might take the form of linguistic affiliations, a kind of common traditions, common sense of historical memory. And I deny that those additional features are necessary or often also desirable in a certain way. So I don't think it's a desirable thing to kind of privilege, you know, one language as a marker of who we are or one set of traditions, at least in the face of diversity within the territory, which is almost always the case. Now, there are some small groups, I think, that are really very homogeneous, so it's not as big of a worry in those cases where everybody shares the culture. Then if we want to sort of enshrine it in our institutions, then we're not sort of telling some people that they don't belong or that they're second class or something like that. But if you have a heterogeneous population, which typically most nation states do, then I think that when you enshrine, okay, the culture, this is who we are, you're telling people who don't share that you're not part of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that's the problem of the hegemony claim.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. So just to back up here before we move on to the final part of the book, one of the questions I had was whether all of the values that you claim particular nation states foster, whether all of that can't be also secured by something like a world state, you know? So, I mean, if I guess shift over from the nationalist side to the cosmopolitan side, right? Wouldn't a cosmopolitan person say, well, a world state can grant occupancy rights to particular peoples to secure their life plans. A world state can secure basic justice. And a world state can foster collective self-determination via some kind of federated system. So why maintain this sort of Westphalian form of state sovereignty, which just, I guess, allows for these kind of America first type moves on the part of existing nation states?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that I maintain the Westphalian form of sovereignty in particular, because I suggest that what I am justifying is something that's considerably less extensive and robust than the set of claims that states currently make.
Mm-hmm.
So in the last chapters of my book, for example, I suggest that there are, you know, enforceable duties to cooperate with other states in international institutions to discharge, you know, certain responsibilities to protect common interests. So I talk about that with respect to certain duties of environmental justice, and I also talk about the duty to accept refugees. And these things, to me, mandate certain kinds of cooperation that are at odds with the kind of, you know, I guess, Westphalian understanding. But I do worry about the idea of a world state, I guess, because I guess I worry that it can be legitimately imposed on people. Now, I don't want to rule out that there's a route from my values to a world state someday, right? It might be that we could all come together willingly to cooperate in a world state, and that might happen via, you know, democratic processes that would grant some subsidiarity to each unit and would allow people to come together to constitute global political institutions. And I don't rule that out. In fact, I suggest that that might be possible, that global political entrepreneurs might persuade us of that project. But I think if that hasn't yet happened, then to impose a world state on people who don't willingly accept it, is going to compromise this interest in political autonomy that they have in being ruled by institutions that reflect their priorities and institutions that they don't see as hostile, subjugating forces. And I think that those are important interests. They're not absolute interests, but I think that they are important interests. And so that's why I, at least in the present day, kind of skeptical about the world state. I don't think it could be legitimate under present circumstances. In the future, perhaps it could be made legitimate, but I think that that would require an effort at, you know, political entrepreneurship to get people on board with the project.
Right. One of the points you made, which was particularly good, I think, was the way in which you might imagine something like these cosmopolitan efforts being undertaken on the part of, you know, rich and powerful countries that are imposed upon, you know, weaker and less powerful countries, and, you know, the ways in which that can create extra burdens on those less powerful countries. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of, it seems to me Kant is very much in the background of your thinking. I don't know. I mean, Kant comes up quite a bit. I don't remember in this particular context, but Kant, of course, has a, you know, he's a famous cosmopolitan, but he doesn't go so far as a world state. In fact, he argues that this could be a universal despotism, in part, I think, for similar reasons, that he's worried about European countries in the colonial era expanding their tentacles toward across the globe, but yet he opens up the possibility to sort of continual progress. Is Kant the real figure behind your book?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, sure. Yeah, I mean, Kant is controversial, but I think that both in my account of self-determination that I root it in a kind of reading of Kantian concerns, particularly about, so in Kant's political philosophy, he's very concerned about what he calls unilateralism. So the unilateral kind of enforcement of justice on people is, he thinks, wrong. And it can be wrong even if what you're enforcing is a good thing. And it's wrong because it doesn't respect people's rational agency in the right way. The agency that they have and the claim based on that agency to deliberate about what kind of institutions they want to live in and how they should be governed. And so I take that idea very seriously. And at the end of my book, in the very last pages, I do come back to Kant's opposition to a world state, and it's something that I agree with. So I agree with Kant that we do have cosmopolitan duties of justice, and that we have a responsibility to come together into, you know, multilateral international institutions to discharge those. But I also agree with him that those institutions should not take the form of a unitary world state with kind of coercive executive power. And precisely for these kinds of concerns that it's not clear to me that it could be legitimately imposed, at least under current conditions.
I thought we could talk briefly about immigration, which you talk about in, I think, the penultimate part of the book. Maybe you could sketch your view again. I have Sarah Song's view in the background, whose view about immigration, I think, is somewhat similar to yours. I don't know if you've read her book, if you want to compare it. But in some ways, as I understand your view, the states have a right to exclude. They have control over their borders, but that right is conditional. It needs to be balanced against the needs of especially refugees and other immigrants who have strong claims, who are stateless, who don't have opportunities elsewhere. So maybe you could talk about that, how you conceive of the balancing between states' territorial rights and the rights of immigrants or refugees to land that's not where they were born or not their home.
Yeah, so I mean, I have, there's sort of two cases in my view in terms of thinking about immigrant claims. So one case is the case of people who are forced to migrate out of necessity. That could be because their rights aren't protected at home, or it could be because they don't have a territory somewhere else in the world where they can have political self-governance for themselves or practice their culture or have their located life plans. And those people, I think, have a very strong claim against existing states to be allowed to migrate. And also, in my view, to be allowed to exercise political autonomy within the place that they migrate to. So they could migrate potentially as a group and have some claim to sort of be settled together and to maintain cultural practices and maybe even to be self-governing in a new territory. So that's, again, kind of part of this view that drawing and redrawing political boundaries is an ongoing project in my view. So just the fact that a state has governed an area up to now doesn't mean that they have a claim forever to that area in the face of, you know, of other groups that might not have territory.
Yeah, I mean, I think about this in Texas, for example, which our governor just recently came out saying that he will not accept any refugees into Texas anymore. It was, you know, it's sort of amazing. And you can drive across Texas. There's just vast swaths of land that are unoccupied that could be occupied by other people. It's just, it's really pretty staggering when you think about existing countries and the amount of land that rich countries and the amount of land that they do have that could be occupied by others, right?
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's a problem. I mean, this is the way in which the kind of cosmopolitan idea of common ownership continues to feature in my view. So we do own and share the earth together. And I don't think that we have permanent, indefeasible claims to it in the face of necessitous outsiders. And those, to me, that the claims of refugees are enforceable. So I think it is acceptable for other countries to exercise proportionate force to get countries to accept their fair share of refugees. And I do think that there's, you know, that there are duties to cooperate in establishing global institutions that can better adjudicate the situation of refugees. So those are pretty strong claims on the part of refugees, in my view. Now, on the part of economic migrants, or I call them opportunity migrants, migrants who have other concerns. They're not forced to migrate out of necessity, but they want to avail themselves of the more desirable life opportunities in another country. I also think that the state should allow them to migrate as long as they pose no threat of significant harm to the inhabitants. But that to me is not an enforceable duty. It's an important duty of justice, but it's one that ought to be recognized and implemented by citizens themselves in their domestic democratic process. So I think we have lots of duties of justice that kind of constrain what we should vote for and how we should think about organizing ourselves, but I don't think all of them are of the kind that allow outsiders to sort of coerce us into complying or to intervene in some way in our domestic processes. And I think the duty to allow economic migrants to come is a duty of that kind. So I don't think that there's a moral right to exclude economic migrants in most cases, you know, in cases where they wouldn't pose any kind of harm to the state's inhabitants. But if the citizens vote to you know, have a restrictive migration policy, I don't think they can be forced by other states to refrain from doing that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a duty of, why is it a duty of justice, I guess, for, I mean, it sounds like, it, you know, it's something like Joe Karen's and the sort of open borders argument would make that peoples just have a human right to do business or do economic business anywhere. And so we have a duty of justice to allow that. Is that why it's a duty of justice?
Why is it a duty? I wouldn't necessarily call it a human right. I think a lot of our duties of justice don't rise to the level of human rights. So think about our duties of distributive justice internal to our own state. So I think that we have, you know, duties to ensure an egalitarian distribution of resources in our own domestic country, but I don't necessarily think there's that rises to the level of a human right. So we generally think human rights are kind of protect especially vital interests and not just any claim that we might have, even any claim of justice that we might have. So when I say that there's a duty to allow economic migrants to come, I'm talking about, you know, claims of justice that fall short, I guess, of human rights claims. I mean, typically, I think we also believe that other countries can exercise some amount of force in defense of human rights, whereas I'm not sure that we can exercise that kind of force in defense of economic migrants. Mm-hmm. So I do disagree with Karen's in a certain way, but I think there are lots of claims of justice that we ought to recognize. So when I go to the voting booth, I think people have a claim of you know, of justice to gun control. I think people have a claim of justice to a better system of public education funding. Mm-hmm. I think people have a claim of justice to, state subsidized childcare. I don't think all those claims rise to the level of human rights. And I don't think that if the United States fails to recognize and enshrine those claims into its system of law, that we can be necessarily intervened on by China or, you know, some other major world power.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, I thought we could finish by, you talk a couple times in the book about the Israel-Palestine case, and we've mentioned that already in the conversation. So here's the usual way in which I kind of conclude by asking you to solve a massive problem. But yeah, I mean, maybe just to motivate this,
how would you solve the Israel?
Right. And so I'm not going to ask it in that way, because, yeah, I would outdo myself by asking that. But I ask this as an example because it strikes me as one of the most prominent contemporary examples of a territorial conflict, right? That is, the two groups that have a common claims to common land, you know, similar land. I mean, in those kinds of case, or in those kinds of cases, how do you start to think about sort of resolving that kind of issue?
Yeah, I mean, so I do sort of make, I don't offer any kind of full resolution or anything in the book, but I do make various, I remark on the case in various different places in the book. So for one thing, I think that Palestinians do have a right of return. But I don't necessarily think that means that they have a right to go back to their ancestral villages in Israel, places that their grandparents might have been expelled from in 1948. I think that, you know, descendants of the Palestinians who were expelled are often still living in refugee camps, or they're second-class citizens somewhere else. They haven't been able to, you know, acquire another territory where they're really able to practice their culture and live freely. And I think that means Israel has an ongoing responsibility to them, to facilitate their return to areas of what was once Palestine. Now, that could be the West Bank, for example. It wouldn't necessarily have to be the villages that they once lived in or their grandparents once lived in, on my account. I also think that the Palestinians have a claim to self-determination, and they have a claim to have a state of their own and a viable state of their own. So I think, you know, the Israeli settlement projects are at odds with that claim, and would be condemned, on my view. And so I think any, you know, viable solution is going to have to entail dismantling the settlements. But, you know, I'm a two-state, I think the principles in my view point towards a two-state solution with significant compensation from Israel. You know, the Palestinian state also needs to be viable, which, you know, is going to involve claims on, you know, shared regulation of water resources and other kinds of important, you know, shared geophysical resources in the area. But I'm definitely a proponent of the two-state solution.
Okay. Good. Well, Annie, this was a great conversation. I love reading the book. And so thank you for taking the time to talk with me for so long and entertain these questions.
Appreciate it. It was lovely to meet you.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us, and thanks to you for listening.